House Committee on Judiciary come in order. Today is June 11th, 2013. This is an informational joint hearing between the House and the Senate. And we're going to be talking about the Board of Parole and Prison Supervision. And first, I'd like to call Aaron Felton up, please. And what we're interested in here is just finding out how we can improve any process that there is. This is what we might be able to do in the future to make things work better for everybody. So please go ahead and remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Chair Barker and Chair Przanski, and honorable committee members. My name is Aaron Felton. I'm District Attorney for Polk County, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Prior to my election as District Attorney, I served as Chairperson of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. It is a distinct privilege to be asked by the chair, I'd say both chairs, today to appear before you. During my years with the board, this committee, both committees, I was always strongly supportive, and I'd say both committees, both the House and Senate committee, judiciary committees separately, and certainly jointly when you met together in the past, was always strongly supportive of the board's mandate and mission. And whether it was providing formal testimony or simply working with committee staff, the reception here was uniformly gracious, engaged, and professional. It is also a great privilege to present the views of my fellow elected district attorneys from around the state. It's an organization truly committed to offender accountability, justice, and protecting the rights of victims, and I'm very proud to be a part of it. After your last hearing regarding the board, I was left with the impression that this committee has set itself up a tremendous opportunity as criminal justice professionals to have a meaningful discussion about the board's procedures. To that end, I would like to offer a few general concepts based on my own experience. I'm aware that the committee is considering during the interim having some additional hearings on the process, which I think is an outstanding idea. As a general proposition, it is good to underscore the core constitutional role played by the board. Article 15 of the Oregon Constitution sets forth the foundation principles of criminal law in Oregon, and I'm quoting, "Laws for the punishment of crime shall be founded on these principles: protection of society, personal responsibility, accountability for one's actions, and reformation." Really, if you start considering all the board's functions, it sits at the intersection of those principles. So as you're considering what might be done, what might make things work better, differently, more efficiently, or on a more practical basis, here are some concepts. If you're looking at perhaps more information in the board's hearing packet, and that's the packet the board has at each hearing, it's the packet, the same packet that the offender gets. It's the packet by statute and rule that the district attorney is entitled to, the district attorney from the committee and jurisdiction, as is the victim or victims. In addition to the items in ORS 144.125, the legislation could make it explicit that ORS 144.185, which allows the board to have access to any relevant information available to it, could be clear that all information could be had by the board. You could remove the word relevant if you thought about it. Again, these are broad concepts, require an additional conversation. Just by saying that, obviously, you're thinking through what would that mean, how would that be accomplished, and what would be the impact of removing that. I assure you, during my time at the board, these are conversations that the board would have on a regular basis in its rulemaking process. Do recall or do know that any information that the board might receive, also the offender might receive that as well. Think about the impact of that, because these items might go within the institution as well. That has an impact. There's confidential documents. There is a area right now in which confidential information may not be shared with the board. This is a much shared with offenders. This is a very litigated topic, hotly litigated. The board litigated that during my time. An example of what might be considered confidential would be information in the form of a letter from a victim to the board. Whether an offender receives that or not is a source of great controversy. This is something by legislation can be made explicit that those documents would not be shared with an offender. It's something to be considered.
Thank you.
Number three. The legislature, although I know this is the bailiwick of the governor, this is an executive appointment as for those who sit on the board. Legislation could be drafted for legislatures could to be more involved in the appointment process. When I was appointed to the chairmanship of the board, or to be chairperson of the board, I misquoted in the statute there, it was an open recruitment process. I actually went through two vetting processes. First, there was a public vetting process with stakeholders, and I was questioned by representatives from victims advocacy groups, prosecutors, and other stakeholders from the board from all sides of the aisle, so to speak. Then I went through a private vetting process of the staff of the board and Department of Corrections and other internal stakeholders. It was an open recruitment process run by Department of Administrative Services. That could be looked at as being a regular portion of the appointment process. I'd also urge one thing that the legislature could look at as well is once you have someone appointed, what are the conditions that you're appointing them to? Currently, and I would advocate that you have a conversation perhaps with the executive branch, you may be aware that this governor has installed essentially term limits on all his boards and commissions. The parole board members are limited to two terms of 4 years apiece. That's 8 years. Parole board service requires a great deal of technical knowledge, legal background in administrative law. They're highly knowledgeable positions requiring a great deal of background. When you have someone who is knowledgeable, experienced in that area, for them then to be term limited to 8 years, that may or may not be what the legislature wants. I believe that's within the governor's discretion to make that decision on his boards and commissions. It may be a topic of conversation for this body to have with the executive branch about whether for this type of board it's in the best interest of the state. Also, please be aware in the recruitment process there are some limitations. Parole board members do not qualify for police and fire in PERS. So when you're looking at someone who may be coming from law enforcement or a position that does qualify for police and fire, that's a consideration for people giving that up, that benefit, when they come to a board position. People may lose their union benefits. People may, if they want to return to a union position after service on the board, may have lost some of those rights. They may lose their law enforcement certification. So there are some disabilities in coming to the board that people have to consider. That may be something, and when you're looking at the overall package in terms of retention, I know when I was chairing the board, when we looked at prospective members, that was an issue for us as well. You may look at the notification process. Currently, the board notifies by statute up to the district attorney for the committing jurisdiction as well as victims. You may want to look at other folks that might want to be notified, such as law enforcement as well. Look at the logistics of that. Do all those individuals want to be notified? How should they be notified? And what form of notification would be most practical and effective? In conjunction with whatever format that this body undertakes to consider these issues, please be aware that there is an existing vehicle that could be called into service as well. When the first Gilmore hearing occurred, prior to my taking service as chair, there was a group called the Parole Hearings Work Group that a prior chair called into service. There was a series of hearings in regards to how parole hearings ought to be conducted. That group can still be called into service by the chair of the board. It consisted, I know that victims' advocates were there, prosecutors were on that board, they held hearings, notes were taken. It's still within the format for that group to be called into service as well. So there is an existing group that could be brought back into life, so to speak, and given an agenda of topics to hold a work group and hearings on the side. I believe that in conjunction with this group, the Judiciary Committee or other legislative committees could work with the Parole Board and the Chair to execute an agenda for that group to consider. One final item is decisions are made at the end of hearings at that time. That's been the tradition. That was the tradition and the practice when I was the chair. One might consider adding essentially a perhaps a cooling-off period after those decisions are made. Could be up to 10 days that after the board hears something, they could leave the record open, or you could just insert a period of time that the board shall not issue a decision until X number of days has passed. I presume that you would want to then, you'd have to allow, if any additional information came in, for the inmate to respond to that. That's an idea, but you could perhaps at least have a period in which after the hearing is held for the board to hold off making a decision for whatever reason. That might be one concept that this body might broadly consider. Those are some thoughts. Service on the board is something I was proud of as part of my career. I'm proud now to be in elective office as a district attorney. Again, I'm honored to have been invited here, and that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Like to ask you, what are there any outlined qualifications for membership on the board for the appointment? Is that
not by statute? Okay. The one statutory mandate is that one of the members be a female.
Yeah.
I don't know why, it just is. Currently, there are, by statute, 5 members are authorized by statute. You're funding 3.
Yeah.
I advocated, as did prior chairs, for additional board members. Just as a, I guess, as a commercial, I would advocate for those who, in this building, advocate for more funding. I still think, as a citizen of the state, that would be a good idea for an additional board member. I think for the variety of things that this board does, and I perhaps defer to the current chair to talk about broadly about the board's functions, I think that would be a good thing.
Hey, thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have a few questions, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
So one of the problems that we heard in a previous hearing, I think it was next week, was that the DA had been notified, I think it was 17 times, about this hearing happening. And so it somehow slipped his attention because apparently of other materials he also got. So can you think of a way that that might have been made a better process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, I don't know how the district attorney in that office, how his office procedures work. I cannot speculate how it would work better. If I do speculate, other than an individual phone call from the board in each case, I would start getting into the place of saying that would perhaps work better, but then I'm suggesting in order to do that, there is a corollary price tag on doing that. Currently, the board has one individual who is responsible for providing the notice, sometimes up to 2, but they're burdened with many, many other functions. There's a victim's service specialist who does that. That's one person, and I could go into the range of duties that she has, or that position has, rather. It was a woman at the time I worked there, but that position is designated. And then you have a hearing specialist who has a variety of very complex duties as well. That could work. I would say if that were to be instituted, it would require an additional staff person to accommodate a direct phone call to that person. I receive those letters in my mailbox. I open them. But I would say I have a special background in knowing what they mean, so I'd hate to speculate. That's a long answer to a short question. I apologize, Representative.
That's just what I need here. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Follow-up. So is this a full-time position for each of the board members?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, yes, it is. It is a full-time plus position. No member of the board when I was on the board ever worked less than at least 40 hours a week. If I may, service on the board is not simply what people see when you have a hearing. That was the topic of discussion. Mm-hmm. That's just maybe a third of what the board does. The board also handles all the post-prison supervision sanction cases that come before it, which is a daily duty for the board, considering all the sanctions that come before it from around the state. So that's a lot of reading, a lot of decision making. Frankly, in this this is not scientifically accurate, but I would say that board members actually sanction people who are on post-prison supervision to more actual jail time sometimes than I think actual circuit court judges might. You have that, but you also have administrative reviews, which is when board members have to consider and draft responses to, which is what when an inmate is dissatisfied with a decision of the board, they have a right to appeal that. That is the first level of review for an inmate or an offender. Board members are required to hear that or read it, and these are all written documents or by computer. They review that and they have to respond to that as well. So that's just another layer of responsibility for the board. So just those duties alone, in addition to preparing for the hearings, such as the ones about the Porter decision or the Porter case, of which the statistic that when I was a member of the board was approximately 200 hearings a year, and you start preparing for those approximately 2 weeks in advance, if not longer, if you have the materials prior to that. So it is easily a full-time 40-hour a week job plus, and that's why it's salaried, and that's why it has a full benefits with the PERS package as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Felder. I really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Thank you, Chair Posansky. Okay.
Mr. Polk, Kristen Wingus-Yanez, please. And thank you for coming over again. We appreciate that. And of course, what we're trying to do here is just look and see what we might do to improve things in the future.
Thank you, Chair. Kristen Wingus-Yanez, I'm the Chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I really, as you say, I'm happy to answer questions about our processes. I thank District Attorney Felton for his excellent summary of some of the board's business and some of the challenges that we face as an agency. It is the goal of the Board of Parole to make our hearings as open and accessible as possible to district attorneys, to victims' representatives, to offender families, and to the public at large. And I understand that our processes can be very confusing. We are dictated by the law that is in place when the offender committed his crime or her crime, and that does make for a legally complicated arena that we are moving through. So to the extent that we can make the process accessible to folks, that is absolutely our goal. Our administrative rules also, if they're substantive, the rules in effect at the time of the crime are what dictate what happens at the hearing. If they're procedural, we can make changes to those, and those are we do use the current procedural rules. That is certainly a goal of past chairs and myself to make our procedural rules as understandable as possible. We are going through changes. We, in fact, just last week voted a rule change that was put into place last September, trying to clarify our rule on hearings procedures. So these are things that we are undertaking. I believe I spoke at the last hearing about our rules on notice and the statutes that dictates the notice that we provide to district attorneys and to victims' representatives. And if there are any additional questions on that notice, we do notify district attorneys and victims. It is a form that goes out twice a month, every 15 days, and as soon as the hearing is set, it gets put into that system. So it's typically around 90 days, around when the offender hears of his hearing, that the notice is going to the district attorney and to the victim's representatives. Now, they will continue to receive that notice every 15 days until the hearing, which is how we got to a situation where there were 17 notices total for the three Porter hearings that were held last year. So that is a system that was developed pursuant to statute, the victims' rights statutes, and in fact, we are providing more notice than is requested by the statute. As for the information that is before the board, District Attorney Felton did refer to that statute already, but it is statutory what is in our packets, and we have rules further delineating what the board sees and what is in our files. Now, we do see additional material as board members, as District Attorney Felton mentioned, board members do prepare anywhere from 3 weeks to the day before a hearing, and if board members have more questions about an offender, if something doesn't make sense in that pre-sentence investigation, for example, the board members can seek out additional materials. There are some limits to that in that as District Attorney Felton also testified, we do need to provide those materials to the inmate ahead of the hearing and to make the process fair to the inmate as well. And if there are any further questions about what is in the board's record or other questions about our processes, I'm happy to answer those.
Okay. One of the questions I had, the people missed the notice, and we know that these are old cases that you're dealing with. So probably most of the time, the DA who was there originally is no longer around, long retired. So would there be a possibility, would it make any sense? And again, let me back up one step. What we don't want to do is come up with some rules that make no sense and just make extra work to no avail. We don't want that. But would it, on a murder case, would it make sense to have a separate notification, like on red paper or something, or big print, so that it really catches the attention, so that it doesn't, get just passed by because they get a lot of mail? And would that be helpful or not?
Chair Barker, I will say that the bulk of the cases that we see are murder cases just because of our parole system. So in terms of whether we make certain crimes, we provide a different kind of notice. That's something that we could talk to the district attorneys about. I'm certainly willing to look at that. I know in our system, it would be a challenge to treat certain crimes differently than other crimes. And I know that an issue in this case was the specific type of murder that it was, namely the victim was an officer, and I know there has been talk of having special circumstances when there is an officer murdered. And to that, I understand that is a heightened situation for the community, and we obviously treat it extremely seriously, but I hesitate to treat any victims of crime differently from one another. These are all horrible crimes. And these victims are all very special to us. So I'm happy to look at that. That might be something. If on our notice we can provide information about what the crime was, when we get to talking about providing information about the facts of the crime, that gets us into a very murky area. Okay. But certainly the crime, that's something that we can look at.
It was my understanding, I've never seen a notice, so I don't know what they look like, but that they came out and they say we're having a hearing and then list several names or something like
right.
that.
Right.
And then I also want to say to the board, Mr. Scroggins is on vacation this week, is why he didn't come today, and he met with me on Friday to explain that. And thank you for coming over. Mr. Cameron.
Representative Cameron. Thank you. So the notices go out every 15 days. Starting at the 90-day period, is there a way that a district attorney would acknowledge I've got the notice and you would cease sending further notices, or do they just keep going?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, the notices are sent out automatically. We could look at whether we do something to ensure that they've been received, but it is a process we send out. We do have a lot of hearings every month, and we're sending out notices for a three-month period, roughly, again, as soon as they're scheduled, or roughly 90 days. And that is quite a bit of paperwork. It's something that we could look at. Again, this is a staff issue for us in terms of whether we're confirming that the notice is received or not. Now, if you're in Multnomah County, you're getting a notice that might list 15 hearings on it, and of course, if you're in Grant County, you will get a notice likely that only has one hearing on it. So it is different for different counties.
Follow up, if I may. Yeah, it seems like we could probably review the notice system and make it more efficient. That we wouldn't need to continue to send somebody if somebody on the other side has acknowledged. I've got that on the calendar. We're contacting the victims. The other thing I wanted to, maybe this is more of a point. Your comment about treating, and I totally understand your comment about treating one set of victim, one victim different than another victim. I'm not a police officer, never was, and I respect my colleagues who have been, but I always have heard that the police or the firemen, the department, are more like a family. And I think in the previous hearing, the comment that I would love to see is if there is a public safety officer who's been the victim, that family of whoever that public safety agency would be notified in the future. And I don't think that would be, I don't see that as treating one victim differently, because the agency is a victim in this case, as well as the family. So that'd be my point made.
Well, Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, I understand that, and I did mention at the last hearing that any agency, it is not automatic for the board to designate or just begin notifying, which is a designation of a victim's process. It is certainly something that we can look at. Of course, if any agency, such as a police department, would like to be notified, all they need to do is call our office. And in terms of automating that, we would want to talk about logistics and what the limits to that would be for our office, so that we understand what folks want to receive. And that's certainly something that we can look at.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Robert. I'm sorry.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine's a procedural one. So you have your hearing. If the parole is denied, is there a procedure for them to appeal that in your procedures or not?
Chair Barker, Senator Roblin, I guess I'm asking a clarifying question.
Right.
Who are we asking?
So, the inmate is appealing and wants to have parole, and they go through the parole process. They get to the parole board, and you deny them the right to parole. Do they have rights then to appeal that decision?
Yes, Chair Barker, Senator Roblin, yes, they absolutely do. It starts with the administrative review process. They file an administrative review request to our office, and we are a quasi-judicial agency. Those administrative review request responses are directly appealable to the Court of Appeals, and we have, you know, quite a few legal actions going at any time, and those are appealable.
Go ahead, Representative Tomei.
Well, if I just follow up on that, so then do you appear at the Court of Appeals to argue your decision?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, we are represented by the Department of Justice Appellate Division.
I see. And if I could have one more question. How many staff do you have?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, we have 14 FTE in our office right now. We are just under fully staffed. That's 3 board members, an executive director, and 11 staff members.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Senator Prozonsky, yeah, please.
Thank you for being here. So I guess I want to kind of go over the notice again. 90 days is when the first one goes out, and then every other week, every 2 weeks, we send another one. Why and what was the basis, if you know, for us sending them out every 15 days instead of maybe starting off 30 days twice? Because I could see for people being notified, and if anyone can be on the list, such as a victim, would they receive that many notices as well? Anyone that's on the list, I assume.
Chair Prozonsky, I believe that the folks who are on the list would receive the notices up until the hearing date. This system has been in place for a long time. As I understand it, this is an automatic system that was created to ensure that if hearings are scheduled closer, for example, to the hearing, that we are providing as much notice as possible of our of an upcoming hearing. So it does add up. For a given hearing, you might get 5 or 6 notices for that one hearing every 2 weeks, and that is paper that might be adding up. But if you are, again, if you're Multnomah County, every notice is going to be slightly different, because hearings are going to drop off when they've occurred and new ones are going to be added. So it's just a full and complete list, and it allows us to just send one notice with all of the upcoming hearings. And you can look at that notice every 15 days and see everything that's coming up for the next 90 days. And we can certainly look at that, but that process is in place, and I believe it is for efficiency and to provide the best notice.
Right. Mr. Chair, I think following up with Representative Cameron said, I'm hearing this, and it just sounds like we're over-noticing, and I can see where stuff could actually get lost through that process. And not knowing who actually can put themselves on the list to get the notices concerns me, as if a victim is getting these notices every 2 weeks, I know that it may be voluntarily that they're on the list, but it seems like we're just compounding the angst of the anticipation of moving forward. So I understand if this was done by rule, that's one thing. If it's done by statute, then I'd like us to look at it to see and make sure that we get proper notice out, ensure that people get that notice in some fashion the best we can, but not over notice, because that seems like that is a cost factor and also impacts your staff. Hearing what Aaron Pelton told us, that there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done, and it seems to me efficiency and clarity is part of that need for us to be sure that we're doing the right thing.
And too much could become white noise. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah. President Roblin? Senator Roblin?
Yeah, thank you.
Old habits, hard to break.
If I understand right, we're talking about approximately 200 hearings a year. Are those the only ones that are noticed, or are there other hearings or other actions that are also being noticed in these notices?
Chair Barker, Senator Roblin, in terms of hearing notices, these are the only hearings that we have, so that is what's noticed. There are victims, and I do want to clarify that with our victim specialist does work with them, it does call them. If victims wish to stop receiving even a notice of a certain hearing, they can certainly do so. They will frequently be in email contact with our victim specialist. We're very fortunate to have someone in that position, and she works really directly with the victims. Whatever it is that makes them most comfortable, whether they want to be involved in the process or not, that is something that is a case by case for each victim, and we do work with them in that process.
Senator Cruz.
Speaking on the victim side, is there any connection made between your victim advocates and those in the local district attorney's office?
Chair Barker, Senator Cruz, we do work closely with the victims' advocates in district attorney's offices. Often there is contact between, for example, if we're trying to get, if a victim wants to make a statement but they aren't comfortable coming to a board hearing, our victim specialists will often work with the victim specialist in the district attorney's office to get that statement, and we can designate it as confidential, and there's a process that we go through. So there is collaborative work.
Okay, thank you. And then when they spoke earlier, we talked about all the information, and I realize, having seen more than one case, sometimes those are so thick. So I would think somewhat of a problem for the parole board to read all the police reports and so on. But it seemed like on the Porter case that you didn't have enough information there, so I don't know. We'll have to think about that and how we can help you get the information you need without making it overburdensome. I mean, there's no sense in, because I know sometimes this report's essentially, you'll have in Portland, you know, 8 police write the same report. Pretty redundant stuff. But
yes, Chair Barker, as I understand, the police reports are voluminous. Obviously, there's something of a workload issue there for us,
yeah,
but also,
right.
I mean, a real concern is what District Attorney Felton mentioned, which is that we are, in essence, making this a public document. Yeah. If we make that police record part of the file, and anything that's in there can be discussed by the inmate at the hearing, it can be challenged in terms
right.
of what we discuss. I will say that we do have hearings where really we rely on district attorneys coming to the hearing. If there are important bits, victim statements, police reports, our executive director, Dre Scroggin, went to the district attorney's winter meeting
right.
in Salishan and talked to them about, you know, there are things that we don't have in our files. It's fantastic if you can bring those to our hearings if you think there's something relevant in it. And we do welcome that.
Thank you. Any further questions? Well, thank you again very much for coming over. We'll continue to work with the board to try and, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me.
So when you were here last week, you were saying how important it is that when you make a decision, it is a firm decision, and the prisoner can, if they don't agree with your decision, they can go to an appellate court, right, and appeal it. And so it looks like in this case that maybe you're going to revisit this situation in the Porter case. Is that correct?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, the board has issued an order reopening the hearing for September. And of course, it is an open case now, so I can't talk specifics about how we came to that decision. But the board did issue that order.
Okay, and how often does that happen?
Representative Barker, Representative Toomey, Chair Barker, excuse me. It is very rare.
Okay, that's what I think.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we appreciate the board considering that case, since that seemed to be high profile, to take a look at the evidence that wasn't before you the first time. And we really appreciate, I mean, I personally very, really appreciate you and the board doing that. It means a lot. And we will continue. We want to thank you again for coming over.
Thank you.
And we will continue with the board to try to figure out how to get this so it works well. And again, not to overburden you with a bunch of things that sound good but are meaningless and just would make more work for you. We don't want to do that because it sounds like you've got plenty of stuff on the table. Thank you again. Is there anything further to the board today? We will adjourn, and the House has to be back on the floor.